So I'm Rebecca, and I've been studying with Geshe Michael for 5 years, and I studied at Sarah Monastery in India, and I'm really excited to be here and to teach and to talk about this really holy stuff. Okay, so I'm going to give you the Tibetan for stuff, and then you should write it down, even if you've never seen Tibetan before, and even if it doesn't make any sense, because it plants a really good seed to learn it in the future. Like, when I started studying, I didn't want to write it down, but I did because Holy Lama said I should, and, you know, now I can sort of read it. I'm studying translation. So it's really good to write it down, and it plants a really, really good seed in your mind, and even if you don't think it's working, it is. So that's my little sell for Tibetan. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about what we're going to be studying, just like a little overview of the course. The book is the Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra, which is here. Okay, and then I should write down the English transliteration for the Tibetan, so you know what that is. Sorry, my handwriting is pretty horrific. I'm working on it. Okay, so the book we're studying... You should always know what book you're studying because, you know, someone might ask you and you might not know, and then you might be really embarrassed. So this is Tekpa. Everybody say Tekpa. Chenpo. Gyu. Lame. Ten. Che. So Tekpa Chenpo. Gyu Lame. Ten Che. And this is Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra. So Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra in the Sanskrit. Okay. And then what does this book mean? So Mahayana is, Mahayana means highest, like highest way. Maha means highest. Yana means way. So that's Tekpa, this is way or vehicle. And then Chenpo means really big or great. So that's greater way. So you've probably heard the term Mahayana practitioner as opposed to Hinayana practitioner. Hinayana practitioner would can be translated as lower way. And there's a difference in the motivation of the practitioners. The Mahayana practitioner, they want to study and they want to reach Buddhahood so they can help others. That's their main intention, is everything they do is to help other beings. And then the Hinayana motivation is more to get out of suffering, you know, to avoid the lower realms for themselves, to reach a state of nirvana, you know, to end their own suffering, you know. And Mahayana practitioners want to do that too. It's not like, oh, I want to bring everyone else to bliss and I just want to be a dumb schmuck, you know. Like, they want to get to Buddhahood too. They want to... You know, okay.
Is everyone done copying or no?
You should write the Tibetan. Yeah. Yeah. It would help you to have the transliteration also. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I know it's annoying, but it'll really help you in the future. As long as you can listen. I mean, it's more important to listen, but if you can listen and write at the same time. Geshe-la says, Gugamare, which means write it, don't carve it. Sorry. Yeah, just. It's kind of funnier when he says it. Okay, so I'm going to go on and then you can just keep writing it. Okay, so. So Gyu means Tantra, and a lot of us know Tantra to mean like the esoteric teachings of Buddhism. It's not what it means in this case. This is not a secret text. This is an open text. In this case, Tantra means lineage or series. Okay. Gyu can mean... I'm sorry. Sorry about that. Gyu means lineage. Gyu means series, okay, which is Tantra, okay. And Chenpo, Lame here, is Lame is Uttara. So Lama we know to mean like teacher, like highest teacher, okay. In this case, it doesn't refer to a teacher. It just refers to the highest thing, okay. And then Shastra is Tenshu, which is commentary. So this is all very confusing. What does this mean? Okay. This means the explanation of the latter part of the series on the teachings of the greater way. So What does that mean? Right. I'm wondering that myself. Okay. So this book was written by Maitreya, okay, who we say is the coming Buddha after Shakyamuni Buddha. Some people say he's a 10th level bodhisattva who's like hanging out in Ganden waiting to get enlightened. Some people say that he is already enlightened. Depends on what school you're in. Okay. He read this, he dictated this book to Master Asanga, and we'll get into how that happened, because, you know, it's kind of rare for a Buddha or a 10th level bodhisattva to be dictating a book to anyone, right? So, why is this book called Uttara Tantra? Why is this book called, like, the highest thing? Why is it, like, the highest part of the series? So, there are two reasons for that, okay? Lord Buddha taught the Dharma in three different ways. Some of you might have heard of three turnings of the wheel. Okay. In the first turning of the wheel, after he got enlightened under the tree in Bodh Gaya, he talked about the four Arya truths, which is sometimes called the four noble truths. He talked about the source of our suffering, you know, where does our suffering come from? Why do we suffer? How do we stop that suffering? You know, and personally, I think for me, that was the greatest draw to Dharma. Like, how do I stop being sad, right? Like, nobody wants to be sad. Nobody wants to have a screaming boss. Nobody wants to get sick. Nobody wants to die, right? So how do we stop that? So that's what he taught in the first turning of the wheel. And he didn't talk about emptiness at all. He didn't talk about the nature of reality. He was getting, the way I see it is he was going more for your gut, you know? In the second turning of the wheel, he talked about the nature of reality, you know? And he said that there was nothing in this world that didn't come as a result of your projections, which are based on your past karma, you know? So everything from your screaming boss to your mother dying to the color of your hair to the color of this carpet to the fact that your pen will write is a result of your past karma, okay? So some of that can make sense, right? Like, I can understand how, like, being mean to someone could, like, cause me to see someone being mean to me in the future. But some of the stuff, like, well, the pen works because it writes. Like, it's a pen because it writes like a pen, right? So some people freaked out after he taught that the pen writes because of your karma, you know? So the third turning of the wheel, he came out and he said, okay, I was just kidding. Sorry about that, guys. Sorry to confuse you. But some things are a result of your past karma. Some things aren't a result of your past karma, you know? So for, like, thousands of years now, people have been trying to figure out, well, which one was it, you know? Like, is everything a result of my past karma, or is it not? You know, which one is it? And it's really important to try to figure out how to stop your suffering. You need to know which one is true. So this book, one of the things that this book deals with is trying to distinguish which one is true. And the book also deals with trying to distinguish how do you distinguish literal teachings from figurative teachings. And that's really important, not only for dealing with the books of Buddhism, but I find, you know, one lama might tell me to do one thing, and another lama might tell me to do something completely different. And one lama might tell me to do one thing, and then 5 minutes later, or a day later, or a week later, or a year later, may tell me to do something completely different. So how do you figure out what you're supposed to do, right? How do you develop your own wisdom, and how do you learn to trust that wisdom? So this book deals with that, okay? Right. So this is, it deals with the last two turnings of the wheel, which is the latter part of the series. So it deals with the latter part of the series in terms of dealing with the latter part of the three teachings of the Buddha, the last two. Okay. Oh, sure. No problem. Sure. The other reason it's called latter part of the series is that Maitreya taught five books to Master Asanga. And within the series of the books, the teachings on emptiness became more and more complicated. So this book that we're studying, can you hear me? Is that okay? Okay. This book that we're studying is the last of the five books. So that's also latter part of the series. Okay. So that's also Uttara Tantra. So when we refer to this book, we don't say Mahayana Uttara Tantra Shastra because that's really long. Okay, we just say Uttara Tantra. And when we say it in Tibetan, we just call it Gyulame or Gyulama. Okay. Okay. That's homework question number one, just so you know. Okay. Yeah. Well, Tekpa Chenpo or Mahayana is referring to who this book was written for. This book was written for Mahayana students. And then later on, later in the week, I think tomorrow actually, we're going to get into what makes you Mahayana. What makes this book written for you? Why was this book written for you? Like, if you're in this room right now and you have the karma to hear these teachings and you're interested, because most people aren't interested in this stuff, like, that makes you Mahayana. And what does that mean? And that's, like, really exciting, I think, and we'll get into it tomorrow, okay? And then I'm just going to read you the names of the commentaries so you don't think that I made this up or that Geshe Michael made this up, okay? The first commentary is called Gyulame Namshe, and you don't need to know it for your homework, but you can write it down if you want. And that was written by Asanga, and he lived around 350 A.D., their explanations on the root text. Yeah. The book that we're reading is the root text, and then these are two commentaries on the root text. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Well, I had mentioned before that you won't be responsible for all the questions on the homework. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to go to what I think are, like, the most important things, and then if we have time, we'll go back to, like, I'll write names of titles down for you. Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important that you know the name of the book you're studying, you know? Okay. And then the second commentary is called Commentary on Uttara Tantra. And that's written by Gyaltsub Jay. And his dates are 1364 to 1432. I'll just write the author's names down. Asanga and Gyaltsub Jay. Okay. So Gyaltsub Jay, Gyaltsub means, this is kind of a side note, but I think it's really interesting. Gyaltsub means regent, okay? And he took over the throne from Jay Tsongkhapa. When Jay Tsongkhapa died, he got the lineage from him. And when Shakyamuni Buddha left Tushita to come to Earth to teach students and take a human body, he left Maitreya in charge of Tushita. So Maitreya became the regent for Tushita. And then Maitreya wrote a book that Gyaltsub Jay, who was the regent for Jay Tsongkhapa, translated or wrote a commentary on. So there's sort of like a lot of regent-king things going on, which is just sort of like coincidental and I think kind of neat. It's not on your homework. I don't think it's on your homework. Okay. Tushita or Ganden? Same thing. Yeah. I always get that confused. Same thing. Okay. So I'm going to tell you a story now, and this is on your homework, and you should listen really carefully because it's a really cool story anyway, okay? So there was a monk who lived in India before 300 AD, and he reached some realizations, okay? And he was doing a secret practice of Chinrezig, who's Avalokiteshvara, and we believe that His Holiness the Dalai Lama is an emanation of Chinrezig. So this monk died, and he was reborn as a woman. And some people say he became a nun. Some people say he, or I should say she, some people say she just wanted to become a nun. But she was noticing that the Dharma in India at the time was really degenerating, and she was really afraid for what was going to happen to Buddhism in India. And she like had a vision that if she had children, that they would be able to sort of rejuvenate the Dharma in India, you know? So out of her great kindness, she either gave back her vows or she decided not to become a nun, depending on who you ask. And she had children. And she saw that if she had a child with a man who was a king, that this child would be this incredible practitioner and teacher. So she had a child, and that child was a sangha. Who remembers who a sangha is? Why is he important? Right. So he wrote one of the commentaries, and he received the teachings from Maitreya and wrote them down. So she was right. You know, he became a really amazing person. So when he came of age, he went to his mom and he said, "Mom, you know, what do I do? I'm royalty. What's the best job for me?" And she said, "The best job for you is to become a monk." You know, and she taught him. She taught him a lot. She taught him the Hinayana scriptures. She taught him the Mahayana scriptures. She basically taught him everything. You know, he was he became so well versed that he memorized 100,000 verses in 5 years, which is it's about 274 verses a day, which is like 1,400 lines of scripture a day. Okay, I had trouble memorizing the blessing for the food, which is 4 lines, okay? So, he was obviously really extraordinary. When it came time for him to study the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which is the teachings on emptiness, he was totally lost, you know? He was totally lost. He was totally confused. I don't know if any of you can relate to that, but, okay, I can, you know? Okay, everything's empty. What does that mean, you know? And how do I apply it to my life, you know? So he got a practice from a teacher on Maitreya, on it was a sadhana on how to reach Maitreya, you know, how he could personally get Maitreya to come and teach him, you know, which is pretty cool to think about that, you know. So he got really frustrated and he said, "Forget it. I'm going to a cave. Okay, I'm just going to sit in a cave for 3 years, and I'm gonna pray to Maitreya. I'm gonna pray with all my heart, and I'm gonna ask him to come to me, and I'm gonna ask him to explain these teachings to me." You know, so he went into the cave, and he prayed, really, really, really hard, and he gave it 3 years of his life, and nothing happened. You know, nothing. He didn't have further understanding of emptiness. Maitreya didn't come to him. You know, and he's like, "Well, this is lame. Forget it, you know, I tried really hard and I'm done, you know." So he leaves the cave and he's leaving his cave and he's just on his way back to start his life again. And he walks past this old lady and she's got a cotton ball and she's sitting in front of a block of steel and she's rubbing the block of steel with her cotton ball, you know? And he's like, "What are you doing? Hi." "You're the first person I've seen in 3 years. What are you doing?" You know? And she says, "I'm going to make a needle from the steel with my cotton ball." You know? So maybe if he hadn't been practicing in a cave for 3 years, he would have thought she was a little weird and he would have kept walking. But he understood her tenacity and he understood her determination. And he was like, "You know what? If this old decrepit woman can make a needle with a cotton ball and a block of steel, I'm going back to that cave and I'm going to find Maitreya," you know? So he goes back to the cave, okay? He's all revved up, you know? He spends another 3 years. He's praying, "Please come to me. Please come, please come." And he doesn't show up, you know? And he's like, "Forget it, all right? You know, I hope that lady got her needles. Maitreya never came. Forget it. I'm out of here," you know? So he leaves his cave. And he's walking down an edge of a cliff, you know, and he sees that this boulder has been split into 10 pieces. And he sees that there's this water dropping off the edge of the cliff. And he realizes that water, that constant dripping has caused the crack in the boulder, you know. And he realizes again, okay, it's steady practice, you know, it's steady. It's not intermittent practice. And I think that this is something relevant, I feel, especially in my own life, about your Dharma practice and about your meditation. It's not you meditate an hour a week, you know. You sit consistently every day. And if you can only do 20 minutes, then you do your 20 minutes, but it's consistent, you know. So he sees this and he's like, okay, I'm going back to the cave. And he goes back to the cave, okay? And he sits for another 3 years. And guess what happens? Right. Nothing happens. You know, he's like, well, I'm glad, you know, that that lady got her needle. And I'm glad that that boulder split into 10 pieces. But this just isn't working. So he leaves the cave again. And he's like, no, really, this time I'm not going back, you know? But this time he sees a bird. He sees a bird flying in the sky. And he sees the bird's wing hit a cleft in a cliff. It's made an indenture. He realizes that this bird's flapping of its wing has made an indenture in the rock, you know? And so he thinks to himself, what does he think to himself? Yeah, you know, right. Right. He's thinking to himself, I'm not diligent enough. He's thinking that like 9 years, 6 years, 3 years in a cave is not enough. I need to go back, you know, because obviously that this bird has been flapping its wings for, I mean, not this bird per se, but birds in general have been flapping their wings for millions of years, you know, and he's obviously been, you know, this obviously wasn't the first lifetime where he was doing practice, you know. So he returns to the cave. Okay. It's another 3 years. Okay. Guess what happens in the cave? Nothing happens in the cave. This is like a pattern, right? So he goes back. He decides, this is it, man. I'm done. And he means it this time. Like, he's fed up. He's annoyed. He's totally mentally afflicted. Well, I don't know how mentally afflicted you could be after, like, sitting in a cave and doing practice for 12 years personally, but this is what the story says, okay? So he leaves, you know? And he goes into town. And I don't, have any of you heard the story before? Okay. No? Okay. Some of you have. Have you heard it? Okay. So he goes into town and he sees this dog, you know, and the dog is been run over by a cart and his gut is like slashed open and he's being eaten by maggots. And Asanga sees that the maggots are about to crawl to his face, you know, and they're about to start like eating his head and his face and he wants to save the dog, you know. He has this great feeling of compassion for this dog, you know. So how can he save the dog? You know, he's got to get the maggots out so he can sew them up. But he knows that if he removes the maggots from the dog, the maggots will die. I'm like, he's even got compassion for these maggots. I mean, it's one thing to have compassion for, like, an old person. It's another thing to have compassion for, like, a four-legged animal. It's another thing to have compassion for maggots, you know? So, I don't know. Asanga, this whole time, has thought nothing's been going on in that cave. I don't know. To me, the idea of, like, wanting to save the maggots is, like, a great sign of, like, great compassion, you know? So he goes into town, he borrows a razor, and he cuts off part of his thigh. And he's going to give part of his thigh to the maggots. Part of his thigh, he cuts off part of his thigh with a razor, okay? So he goes to remove the maggots from the dog's belly, but he realizes if he scoops the maggots out with his fingers, he's going to crush them, you know? So what can he do? Because he's got this immense, incredible compassion, and he doesn't want to kill the maggots. So can anyone guess what he does? Yeah. What? Not yet. He's got to get them out from the ripped open stomach, right? So he leans over. He closes his eyes. He's a little grossed out. I mean, he's got great compassion, but it's a little gross. Maggots are gross. Like, they are disgusting, you know. Not self-existently, of course, but they're a little yucky. So he closes his eyes, you know, and if I were him, I'd be saying some prayers or something. And he leans over, you know, and he sticks his tongue out, and his tongue hits the ground. And he looks up, and can you guess what he sees? He sees Maitreya. You know? Like, Maitreya is just standing in front of him, you know? So, like, we can all imagine what we would do if, like, we'd been praying for 12 years and Maitreya appeared in front of us. Like, what would you do? Zach? Yeah, what would you do? But we'd all probably think we're going to do something really holy and like auspicious and you know, showing how devout we are, you know. He was really pissed off, you know. He was like, dude, like, I've been praying to you for 12 years. I've been sitting in the cave for 12 years. like, I did everything I was supposed to do. And you're trying to tell me all I had to do was, like, remove some maggots from, like, a dying dog and you show up? Like, 12 years. I mean, like, Ani Palma was in retreat for 3 years, and I'm sure she can tell you, like, 3 years is a long time, maybe. I mean, I think 3 years, yeah, it's a long time. He did four times that, you know? So he's like, what's going on? I don't, you know, and he's like, you know, he's annoyed and he's pissed off. And Maitreya's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I was sitting there with you for 12 years. It's your fault it took so long to find me. I mean, I was sitting there. Like, and in fact, in the morning when you would clear your throat and, like, hawk stuff up, you spit on me, you know? Like, you were spitting on me for 12 years. And Asanga's like, you know what? Like, I would have seen you. Like, I would have seen you if you were sitting there. Like, it was a small cave. I'm not blind. I can see things. I can hear things. You simply weren't there, you know? And Maitreya says, you know what? We'll do a little trick, okay? Why don't you just humor me? Why don't you put me on your shoulders? You walk me around the town. You see how many people see me on your shoulders, you know? So Asanga's like, are you, or whatever, you know? Like, you've got a body made of light. You probably don't weigh so much. So he gets up on his shoulders. He takes him around the town. And I've heard people say that he was really, like, cheering. And, like, I've got Maitreya. Like, look, I've got the Buddha on my shoulders. Nobody saw him. One barmaid saw a puppy. And, a porter saw a toe. And no one else saw anything else, you know. So Maitreya, you know, Asanga realizes that what Maitreya had said was right, that, you know, sometimes you just can't see things, you know. So what took Asanga so long to see Maitreya? I mean, what was the problem? Do you have any ideas? Well, that's true. That's true. But in this case, like, Maitreya definitely was outside of Asanga. Like, he was definitely in the cave. What can you think of why he couldn't see him for those 12 years?
Just because he was actually trying and putting so much effort into trying to see Maitreya, and the fact when he was giving himself to somebody else and all of a sudden he appeared.
So what she said about giving yourself to someone else is really important. Like, that's bodhicitta. Do you know bodhicitta? It's well, you know, desire is an interesting word, and I think it's misused sometimes. Like, I like ice cream, you know. I don't know if I would say I would desire ice cream. I guess you could say, like, sometimes I desire ice cream. If I don't do something to hurt someone to get it, and I'm not hurting myself to get it, like, it's okay to want some ice cream, you know. You have to understand where the ice cream comes from. You have to understand that, like, the ice cream doesn't really come from the ice cream truck. Like, if I get ice cream and I like ice cream, it's because I helped someone else get ice cream in the past, or I helped someone get what they wanted in the past, you know. And in fact, the highest thing that you could desire would be to meet a holy being so they can teach you Dharma so you can help others. Like, that's the most amazing thing you could ever want, you know? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you gotta get to total and perfect enlightenment yourself before you can get someone else there, you know? Yeah, that's important. So, sorry?
Okay. Could you think about it too, just in terms of
emotion,
like you have too much
passion
and the negatives of passion
mm-hmm.
and
yeah.
aggression and just ignorance.
Yeah, sure. Definitely. But what's going to remove that ignorance, you know? Like, sometimes they, you know, they say, like, to meditate on emptiness, right? And the whole thing with Asanga was that, like, he didn't know how. Like, he didn't understand these scriptures. You know, like, okay, sit down and think about emptiness. Well, what is emptiness? Right? Like, emptiness is the lack of a self-existent nature. I mean, I don't know about you, but when I try to sit down and think about a lack of a self-existent nature, like, I have a really hard time because I can't even fathom what the lack of a self-existent nature looks like, because it doesn't look like anything, because it's the absence of something. And we're going to get into that. Like, there's going to be a lot of talk during this class over the next 4 days of, like, is emptiness a positive thing that you can think about, or is emptiness a negative thing? And if it's a negative thing, how the hell are you supposed to think about it? You know? So the really important thing, I mean, like, think about it. Like, he was sitting in the cave. He was trying to think about emptiness. It wasn't until he left the cave and he tried to help the dog and these maggots. I mean, it was bodhicitta. It was kindness, you know? So that's, like, that's really important, you know? So because he, and this is on your homework, okay, because he had this bodhicitta, because he was sitting in the cave, like, it's really important that he was making efforts in this, you know, like, even though it was so difficult, like, he collected the karma to be able to see Maitreya when nobody else could see Maitreya, because Maitreya is empty, you know? I mean, Maitreya is empty in the same way that, like, my old boss is empty, who used to, like, yell at me a lot, and I kind of thought was a jerk, and other people who, he was a casting director, and actors who would come in, who he had gotten, like, $100,000 jobs, loved him. Like, they didn't see him as a screaming boss. They saw him as this guy who, like, made their living and, like, helped them buy a Porsche and, like, you know. So Maitreya is empty in the same way that, like, everything else is empty, you know? So that's really important, you know? And I think sometimes, you know, like, you don't know who's around you. Like, Maitreya was sitting there for 12 years. Like, Asanga was spitting on him. He couldn't see him. Like, Asanga, who sat in a cave for 12 years. And then, like, I think I know who I'm sitting next to. Like, I think I know who my mother is. I think I know who she is when she's nagging me and, like, why aren't you spending the holidays with me? Like, I think I know who she is. I don't know who she is. I mean, and that's emptiness, and that's worldview, you know? Like, what you do, your actions and your body and your speech and your mind totally affect the way you perceive your world. You know, like, you have a problem with your world. You want to change your world. Like, you change how you're treating others, you know? And you understand where they're coming from, and you understand, like, you understand why you're seeing yourself suffer, and you understand why you're seeing other people suffer, and then you try to change it. And, like, that, I think, is the most amazing thing about Dharma, you know, that, like, you can change things, you know? So that's the story of Asanga. I really like that story. Does anyone have any questions about it? Yeah. Well, I think it's a really, like, I think, like, a couple of things about the story are really interesting. Like, one is that, like, one is those stories. Like, he saw the consistency. Like, I think, I mean, for me, I certainly can't speak for anyone else, but, you know, okay, I did, like, a one-week Jeetan Kapa retreat, and I was, like, annoyed that Manjushri didn't show up, you know? I mean, like, 1 week. Come on. Like, I think that I can so profoundly change my karma in a week to, like, see Manjushri, like, show up at my doorstep, and I'm, like, annoyed that he doesn't show up. I mean, come on, you know, that it's, you know, and then you hear, I oftentimes hear people in Dharma classes be like, I've been kind to people for a year, you know, I've been nice to people. I give and I give and people just take and nothing ever comes back to me. And like, well, one thing, you know, is obviously, like, what's your motivation? Are you really helping them? How are you helping them? Like, what's the power of your conviction? But the other thing, like, is it consistent? Like, are you like working at a food bank in the morning and then going home and, like, being obnoxious to your wife or your husband or your kids or your friends? You know, like, it's not this thing where, like, you can just be kind once in a while, or you can just be kind when you're in a good mood, or you can just be compassionate, like, when you're not tired, you know, that it has to, like, really be this consistent thing. So,
karma doesn't necessarily ripen. Yeah. You know, if we do something good, that's going to ripen into something
some positive benefit for ourselves. So there's the expectation of benefit, which is actually kind of wrong view, and then also forgetting that the karma ripens on its own time, and it doesn't necessarily happen even in this lifetime, let alone this week or this year.
Sure.
That would be nice.
Yeah. I mean, if karma was immediate, then I think we wouldn't be at war, and nobody would be hungry, and, Sure. It's okay, sure.
If Maitreya appeared to a Sangha, somewhere in the 12th century, then the original Buddha, was he Siddhartha, was he Maitreya? And the one who's going to come, what's the connection?
Yeah. That's a really good question, and to be quite frank, I have a lot of questions about that myself. So the thing about they say about Maitreya is that when Lord Buddha was teaching, like 2,500 was it 2,500 years ago or it was yeah. So that was 2,500 years ago. They say that at that time, Maitreya was a 10th level bodhisattva. They say that at the time that you see emptiness directly, it generally takes 7 lifetimes, which you could say is like 500 years, to become a fully enlightened Buddha. So you can do the math, right? Like 2,500. Possibly, but that's assuming that every 500 years someone sees emptiness directly. I mean, they say that like, if one person in 1,000 years sees emptiness directly, you're having a good 1,000 years, you know? But it, you know, I've asked Geshe Michael that question, and and I haven't really gotten a very clear answer. So I don't know how to answer it, frankly. They also say, you know, that's tantric way that you can get enlightened in one lifetime or... You know, sutra way is it takes like 3 countless eons, and then in like a countless eon is like 10 with 69 zeros after it, and then there's 3 of those. So, like sometimes when you're reading a Dharma book, you have to look at what school it's in. Like, is it a sutra school, which is an open teaching, which says things take longer? Which, I mean, frankly, the bird flapping its wings on and making the break in the rock, I think could probably be symbolic of that. I'm just putting that on there, but I think that could be symbolic of like sutra way, you know, that takes a much longer time. But they say if you're practicing tantra, it can happen like in one lifetime, which that's cool. You know, that'll put a fire under you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But will people be able to see him is the question. Like, when Shakyamuni Buddha came, like, some people saw a Buddha. And, like, was it one person went and saw him and said, you know, he's got, like, this bump on his head and he glows? And there's, but, I don't know, he's kind of weird. Like, they didn't see him as a Buddha, you know? And I think that that's a really important thing, like... Who's around you? Who and how are you seeing them? And who are they really? Like, I think that's the most important thing about the first class of this series of classes. You know, that it could really make you question, like, who's sitting next to you, and do you really know? You know, and if you're unhappy with who's sitting next to you, then how do you change it? And are you really going to try to change it? You know, like, is Dharma this thing that is it's fun to do on the weekends and it's interesting and you get to meet new people and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, or is it something that you're really going to internalize and are you going to let it change your worldview? Like the entire way you're seeing the universe, you know, is it going to like infiltrate you, you know? It's okay. Yeah, so that was what I said about I'll just give you guys the answers. The compassion is the three ideas of worldview are bodhicitta, you know? karma and emptiness. Emptiness. So let's just do it together. So what's the bodhicitta aspect of the story? Yeah, for the dog. And then what's the karma part? But that he was doing things. It's not like the karma isn't the time that it took. The karma is the actions he was taking within that time. That he was meditating for 12 years and that he actually took the... It's not enough to just like be like, oh, it would be nice to help people. Like, you got to try to help people. You know, you got to take the action. Like, I think everyone wants to help people. I think what sets people aside or sets people apart is that you're willing to get off your butt and you're willing to do something about it. So that's the karma, like... Okay, and then Pamela, what's the emptiness part? Yeah. I mean, have you ever like seen someone in your life just profoundly change? I mean, maybe not like from being invisible into like being visible, but. Like someone at work who is kind of jerky, who like changed, or a friend who changed, or yeah.
Like seeing people. Could you speak up so she can?
Yeah. Like when I think of seeing people change, it's more of like a profound, maybe even a spiritual transformation that results from. Dying or from, you know, something like that, like actually seeing some fundamental change in the person as a result of that. And so, I mean, I guess it could happen on a more basic level too, just somebody realizing, having their eyes open and seeing something that allows them to act differently in the world. But
yeah. See, it's like an interesting thing, right? Like I was in New York when the World Trade Center fell down and I was just in New York for, like, a week afterwards because then I, like, by coincidence was coming to Diamond Mountain to volunteer anyway. But, you know, people got really nice, like, that week. Like, I mean, I got to tell you, the weirdest thing for me about September 11th was not the fact that I saw the buildings fall. It wasn't the fact that people were jumping 100 stories to their death. It wasn't the fact that we got hit by terrorists. I swear to you. Like, the weirdest thing for me was that I was walking down Broadway. I mean, like, I'm 5'1", you know, I'm, like, small. I get hit all the time. I get knocked into all the time. No one ever says sorry. People said sorry. Like, people were shoving me, and people were saying sorry. And, like, to me, like, that was the oddest thing of the entire day. Like, I swear, you know? You know, because something, I saw a change happen in New York. Like, I saw that, now people make eye contact on the street. Like sometimes you might even smile at someone or like say hello, you know, like you see kindness happen. And then like it's a question, right? Like did they change or did I change? Who changed?
They did.
They changed?
But you had to be able to see that change. You can't remember the lies.
So it's who thinks that they changed? Yeah, good.
You know, if you're saying they, then you have to realize that you're either talking about, you know, other people that are the same as yourself or simply objects that are defined by your subjectivity.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. I mean, like, are me and Zach separate or like are we separate from each other? Did you feel something? I didn't feel anything. I mean, that didn't hurt me. Are we separate? Sorry. Are we separate?
You're talking about a relative level or an absolute level.
Right. So what's the relative level? Right. I just smacked him and it didn't hurt me at all. Right. Probably just collected really bad karma, but it didn't hurt me. Okay. Tell him to come after me later. Okay. So what's the ultimate level? Well, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. What's the ultimate level? Like, are we separate or are we not separate? We're not separate? So if he has to pee, I have to pee? No, that's not. So what's ultimate? What do you mean by ultimate?
Well, I guess when I think in terms of the ultimate level, it's almost like the idea of in my mind somehow I was relating it to like interdependent origination or interbeing or you know, kind of that concept. In the sense that I mean hitting and peeing and like those are all very relative things, but when we transcend that then if you fully had transcended that and you were an actual Buddha, then you would be able to see through that relative reality. And so maybe if you did have to pee, experience that too. I don't know.
Well, there are varying schools of like degrees on emptiness, and this actually relates to one of your homework questions, which you don't have to do because we're not going to get into it so much. It's actually you're not going to have to do a bunch of these questions. Is it even on here? I thought it was on here. Never mind. It's not on your homework anyway, so you really don't have to do it. But this, I brought this up because it sort of, remember I mentioned that this was the fifth book? There were five books that Maitreya dictated to Asanga. This is the fifth book. And that the first four books had to do with varying degrees of emptiness, you know? And that the fifth book had to do with what we call like prasangika emptiness, which is like the highest view, which is what Gishala teaches, you know? So some schools do say that like we're separate, you know? Some people say that he's out there and I'm here, you know? Some people say, and I actually don't even think that this is Buddhist. I think this is just an understanding that like we're really one person. But, like, I just hit him and I proved that we're not one person, you know? And then some schools say that that there's, like, a seed in my mind, you know, and that's projecting everything. And it's projecting Zach. It's projecting, like, the way he is. It's projecting his glasses. It's projecting, like, why I see him in the way I see him, you know?
How would you answer the question that you asked me just about
I would have said it depends on who you ask, you know. I would have said like relatively obviously. And there's another word you can use, which is apparent, which Geshe-la has been using lately, and I like it. Because apparently, like it seems like we're separate, you know. I would say that he is a separate person, but I would say that he exists only in the way that my karma is forcing me to perceive him. Yeah, exactly. Because it's, right. Exactly. Because it's either coming, you know, the Tibetans say my mind and the Americans say my mind, you know, so it's coming from somewhere between here and here, you know. So then if I'm changing what's inside, then I'm changing what's outside. So then it comes back, the question is, like, did New York change or did I change, right? So it's depending on who you're asking, right? Like, sure, in an apparent sense, New York changed. But New York could only change because something in one of these places changed, you know. Do you guys need a break?
You want to take a minute to, like, stretch? I always thought I had to give you a break. What time is it?
We're going to 2?
Take a short break.
Yeah, why don't we take a short break just to, like, let your brains thaw a minute. Yeah. So Arya is someone who's seen emptiness directly. Yeah. So the Tibetan for Arya is Pakpa. And this is Tokme. Does everybody say Tokme? Tokme. Again, Tokme. And then Tokme is a Sangha. And I should find out what the literal translation of a Sangha is, because I don't know it. Do you know it, Andriana? Do you know the literal translation of a sangha? Because I don't know it.
It's something like, I can look it up in my notes, something like one who understands.
Okay.
It's like except for emptiness.
Yeah. So you guys can keep writing while she...
The literal meaning is to not to bump into something.
Oh, right. It's like to not bump into something, which is like a knife through hot butter, that his intellect was so sharp that it was like a knife through hot butter. There were no obstacles to what he could understand except for emptiness. But then he became an Arya, so we know he figured it out, right? And then this is, if you want to look up for a sec, sorry. Actually, why don't you finish writing Arya Sangha and then... Oh, good. Oh, do you want to go to Gail's today? Oh, cool. Excellent. Excellent. Cool. Okay, so this is Geltubjay. Everybody say Geltubjay. Geltubjay. And then I'm going to point so you know what letters refer to what. So this is Gel, Seb, Jay, Geltubjay. Okay. And who remembers who Geltubjay is? Right. Yeah, he wrote one of the commentaries. And what's interesting about his name? Yeah. And what's interesting about the fact that his name means regent? His name means regent? Yeah. Right. So what's interesting about that? Jeton Kapa. Uh-huh. Yeah. And Jeton Kapa, right. And he wrote... What did he write? He wrote the commentary. He wrote one of the commentaries we're studying. Master Sangha wrote one of the commentaries on the book that he wrote down that Maitreya dictated to him. Geltubjay? Jeton Kapa was the teacher of the first Dalai Lama. So Geltubjay was the throne holder after Jeton Kapa. He wrote the commentary on the book written by Maitreya. Maitreya is the regent in Tushita after Shakyamuni Buddha wrote, left Tushita. So, yeah. Okay. And then, everyone look up for a sec. Say Jampa. So this is Jam and this is Pa. So Jampa. And Jampa is the Tibetan name for Maitreya. Oh, this is a she. So you'll see all of these have a she. And a she is like a grammatical ending. It's like a period. So you know, and often I forget to put them down, and I've been told to not forget to put them down. So sometimes you might not see one because I might just forget. I'm trying not to. But it's basically, it's a grammatical thing, and it doesn't change the sound of the word. There are a lot of letters in Tibetan that are silent, and they change the way other letters sound, like just like in English, but that's not what the she is. The she is just like a period. Yeah, sure. Like, why are we giving Sanskrit, Tibetan, and English? Well, the Buddha spoke Sanskrit. You know, like, he wasn't speaking English in India. He wasn't speaking Tibetan in India. He was speaking Sanskrit. So a lot of the books were his books. The Buddha's books weren't written down in... Yeah. They were translated into Tibetan when Dharma... Yeah, it was okay. When they got taken... When Buddhism reached Tibet... They sent a bunch of people to, like Marpa Lotawa. Like Marpa was a translator. So Marpa went from Tibet to India to get the books, and he translated them, and he brought them back to Tibet in Tibetan. And then Geshe-la, out of his like infinite kindness for us, and other like holy translators are translating them to English because like most of us can't even read Tibetan, you know. And an inspiration, like a reason to read. Learn to read and understand Tibetan is because you know, we're sort of like the people from Tibet who went to India to get the books in Sanskrit and translate them into Tibetan. Like, if it weren't for, like, their kindness, like, we'd have to study Sanskrit. And Sanskrit is, like, infinitely harder than Tibetan, you know. So you can think of learning Tibetan as like, a gift to other people to translate. Like, you're translating the books for them, you know. Yeah. Yeah. Why we yeah, it's a good question. Well, most of the time, I think when people talk about, like, people like Asanga or Maitreya, they're referred to as Asanga or Maitreya. And if I just came out with Pakpa Tokme, you'd have no, or sorry, if I just came out, yeah, if I came out with Pakpa Tokme, which would be the Tibetan, like, you wouldn't know who I was talking about. Whereas if I referred to, like, someone who is usually referred to in Tibetan, like Jetun Kapa, by his Sanskrit name, you wouldn't know. So I think maybe that's part of the reason. Like, I don't know why some, it's interesting because some of the Sanskrit names, like, did get translated into Tibetan. Some of them didn't get translated into Tibetan. And I don't really know why. Yeah, I don't know why. But I mean, just as far as, like, Diamond Mountain, like, Geshe-la, since being in retreat, has, like, been very interested in yoga. And then those books are written in Sanskrit. And then he's taught Christy, and Christy is, like, a very good Sanskrit scholar now. So I think that there will be, like, a great emphasis on it, you know. But it's interesting because Geshe-la really stresses that, like, Dharma in America is different than it'll be in Tibet. Like, that it's important to know what your prayers mean. Like, you know, he really stresses that that you can say your prayers in English, you know, because the Tibetans don't say their prayers in Sanskrit, you know. Yeah.
All of that is true. I was thinking, like, two things. I mean, even though the Tibetan is very well translated, and usually they, when they translated from the Sanskrit into Tibetan, they had to have a special council of people, and it would often take years. Everyone would have to agree on the exact meaning. And I don't have a good example off the top of my head, but I can look one up for you. Sometimes when you start looking at the Sanskrit, the original Sanskrit, and you compare it to what it's been translated to in Tibetan, you find that some of the, not the essential meaning is there, but sometimes studying the Sanskrit more deeply brings out the nuances in the translation. And you'll probably see that when we start looking at the names for Buddha nature, where the Tibetans, you know, chose to use the same word for something, but when you look back, and it does convey the essence, but when you look back at the Sanskrit, it gives a slightly different flavor to the meaning. And so sometimes for people who want to go a little deeper, there's something nice about looking at the Sanskrit for that reason.
So there's a question on your homework, question 4. Arya Asanga's coming into the world was predicted by Lord Buddha himself in the root. Oh, sure. Great. Yeah, Geshe-la has also been doing some stuff with some Pali texts, but I don't know much about that. But it's cool. Okay, so it's cool. So question 4, Arya Asanga's coming into the world was predicted by Lord Buddha himself in the root tantra of gentle voice Manjushri. How does this, the root tantra of gentle voice Manjushri? This is question 4. Do you have a homework? Yeah, okay. So I'm just reading question 4. Yeah. How does this prediction relate to the fact that the 5 books of Maitreya may seem to contradict each other? So it's what I had said earlier about how this book, the Uttara Tantra, is well, one of the things we're going to be talking about is how to differentiate between literal and figurative, you know? And like I had mentioned, the 5 books talk about different views of emptiness, right? So why would someone do that? Why did the Buddha teach 2 different ways of looking at emptiness?
The latter teachings before, I think, more than able to understand.
Well, the thing is that the second turning of the wheel is highest view of emptiness. So he didn't teach them in order. Right? Yeah. Yeah, it depends on which, you got to check on which school you're in, right? So, but like according to like Diamond Mountain, right? Like Geshe-la teaches Prasangika and says Prasangika is like true. Prasangika is the second turning of the wheel where he said that like nothing is self-existent, nothing is any nature of its own. Third teaching, he said, okay, I'm just kidding. Sorry, some things have a nature of their own and some things don't. The pen writes by itself. The pen is a pen because it writes, makes it a pen, you know? So it's interesting, right? Like, why didn't he teach the second, why didn't he teach the third teaching second? I'm just asking this, frankly, because I wonder it myself, you know? It's an interesting thing. Like, I don't know if you guys talked, if you talk to your friends about Dharma, like your non-Buddhist friends about Dharma, but I often find that it comes up, like people ask me, and it's always a question in my mind, like you're at a party and like there's loud music and someone's like, so why are you Buddhist? Like, which story do you tell them, right? And then, and how much do you tell them? And you just jump into being like, the World Trade Center fell down on your head because, like, you have bad karma. Like, do you say that to someone who's, like, father could have been there? Like, do you say that? Or do you say it in those words? Do you ever say it in those words? You know, like Geshe-la was saying, it's really important that everyone passes stuff on, you know? And so then I think it's an important thing to think about how you would present karma and emptiness. You know?
You can't present it from your own understanding. That would be the quality of a good teacher in a sense that we're teaching to, you know, our friends about such as that. We have to present it to them in a way that is meaningful to them and that they can understand.
Yeah.
And if we're presenting in that way of like karma, well, the World Trade Center fell down, you know, and these people died in that because that was their karma, some people just, you know, that's not going to do them any good.
It's not.
To hear that.
Yeah.
Regardless
yeah.
of whether it's the truth or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it is interesting to think about how you present these things, you know, how you present what you're learning and share what you're learning in a way that is meaningful to other people.
Yeah. Yeah, because not, you know, like some people really, really, really care about dates. Some people really don't care about dates, you know? And some people just want to dive right into, like, a body, you know, a body turning into light, you know, and some people don't. So it's, you know, it's an interesting thing, I think. Yeah. Let me see if there's anything else on your homework we should cover. Okay. Do you know? Yeah. Asanga is really well known for teaching the mind only school, you know, which is the mind only view of emptiness, which is lower than the Prasangika view of emptiness. Like, he taught it, but he didn't buy it, you know. Oh, there's Shentong is like mind only, yeah. Is involved with, well, it's Jonungpa. Shentong is, because I know you guys do a lot of that in Shambhala, right? Yeah, I have to look it up in my notes. Yeah. 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 But it's an interesting thing, you know, because even like what we quote unquote see it as like the lowest or like the wrong view on emptiness can really help somebody to get to the next level, you know? So I even feel uncomfortable saying like the lower view. I feel like it's really, I feel like it's a derogatory name and like that it could really help some people, you know? Yeah. So the last question is, I'll tell you about that because otherwise you can't answer it. According to tradition, question 6, what levels had Arya Nagarjuna, Arya Asanga, and Maitreya reached during their lifetimes? So do you remember what I had said about Maitreya? Right. Maitreya is a 10th. According to tradition, he reached 10th level bodhisattva within his lifetime, which is one step away from Buddhahood. Like a 10th level bodhisattva could be hanging out in Tushita, you know? According to tradition, Arya Nagarjuna reached the first bodhisattva level. So Nagarjuna was an Arya. Yeah. Right. It means he saw emptiness directly, but it means he didn't go through any further bodhisattva levels. Like they say there are 10 bodhisattva levels before you reach Buddhahood. So, personally, like, this is one of those things for myself that when I heard that Nagarjuna was only a first level Arya, I was like, huh? Like, I just always imagined he was like an 8th level. Like, I had imagined he was in Nirvana. Like, he wrote all those things and he was responsible for, he's called like, he's referred to as like a second Buddha, you know? Yeah, just the first level in his life is what they say. Sure. They say Asanga reached the 3rd level. No, Buddha was like the Buddha. Buddha's like the 11th level, which means Buddha. There's no 11th level because it's like just a fully enlightened Buddha. Maitreya, who's the next coming Buddha, they say reached the 10th bodhisattva level in his lifetime, and they say he's like hanging out there waiting to come to earth before he gets enlightened. Well, that's another question, right? This will come up in one of Andriana's classes. Like, is the Buddha enlightened before they get to earth, or is the Buddha enlightened when they get to earth, or is the Buddha not enlightened until they sit under the tree? But that's Andriana's class, so we won't get into that. That's like a teaser. Right, and when did they become a bodhisattva? And how long were they a bodhisattva for? And how long do you have to be a bodhisattva before you reach Buddhahood? And like, I thought Geshe-la said, like, if I practice Tantra, I can reach it in one lifetime. But Arya Asanga only reached the 3rd level? And Nagarjuna was only a 1st level bodhisattva? Like, and I'm supposed to, like, be able to reach something that Nagarjuna couldn't reach? But I trust my lama, and if my lama says that, like, we can all do it in one lifetime, I believe him. So what's going on? And boy, you know, if I understood this book, and I understood how to differentiate, like, literal teachings from figurative teachings, I'd be able to figure this out a whole lot better, wouldn't I? Yeah. So that's that homework question. So I should tell you what you're not responsible for. You are responsible for 1. You are responsible for 2. You are responsible for 3, but if we need to go over that tomorrow in class, we will, because I sort of rushed through it. Or I can just tell you now. Do you guys have those? Okay. Asanga is 350 AD. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to let him go in a minute. Okay. You are related. Yeah. You are responsible for 4. You're not responsible for 5, so don't worry about it. And you are responsible for 6. So just don't do 5. And, yeah, really, like, talk about this. If you want to, if it was interesting, I hope so, then, you know, talk to each other about it and like, have a discussion or a debate. Like, if there's one thing that, like, really didn't make sense or one thing that really, really did make sense, you know, or one thing even that you're apathetic about. Still, discuss it, you know. Yeah, and help each other with your homework, and if you have any questions, ask me. And I think it's about 2, so. Yeah, do tomorrow. Yeah, undo it. Just do it. It should take like 10 minutes. Just do it. It'll help sink it into your brain. And then in tomorrow's class, we're going to talk. I said we're going to talk about like what it is to be a good Dharma student. And then you could think about that. And we're going to talk about the Buddha jewel. Yeah, do your best on that. Yeah. It's okay. Just do your best. I'm grading it, so, and we'll go over it. We'll go over it some more. Yeah, I think. I think, you know, you could ask somebody for advice on something and they could tell you what to do. Or you could ask somebody for advice on something and they could give you a few different ways to look at your problem. And then you learn to develop your own wisdom. And I think, like, the most important thing is to learn to develop your own wisdom, you know. So definitely, you know. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that relates to the answer to question 4 about the literal and the figurative. Like, why do they seem to contradict each other? You know? Yeah. That must be very difficult for those students? Well, they say that the Buddha, like, knows everything, including the nature of his students' minds. So it's not an accident that he taught 3 things that contradict each other. And he knew that we would be sitting in this room in, like, Tucson, Arizona, having this discussion, you know? Like, he knew he planned it, you know? He, like, set causes in motion so it would happen. So it's interesting, right? Had, like, Lord Buddha not taught 3 different ways, like, had not taught 3 different turnings of the wheel, like, we wouldn't have this class. Maybe we wouldn't be here. And maybe Geshe-la would have taught a class that wasn't as appealing to you. Maybe you wouldn't have come all the way from Australia, you know? I mean, it's really interesting. So, yeah.
Would you say he became the Buddha because of his karma, all these teachings, and we are sitting here and all that?
What do you mean?
Did he become the Buddha?
Mm-hmm.
Because today, because of him, we are sitting here and we are talking.
Yeah, he became the Buddha because he wanted to remove the suffering of all the beings, you know. And we're sitting here. It's an interesting question, yeah? Like, we're sitting here because he became the Buddha. We're sitting here because he wanted to become the Buddha. I mean, Buddha's not like God that, like, put us here. But if you believe that there are, like, beings who appear in the world to, like, help you, that they're sort of setting you up for things, then yeah, sure. And it could be someone you don't like, and it could be like your kid, and it could be someone who flew an airplane into the World Trade Center. I mean, it just comes back to Maitreya sitting in that cave and Asanga not being able to see him, right? Yeah. So, yeah.
What is Tushita again? Whose paradise?
It's where Maitreya hangs out.
Oh, it's where Maitreya.
It's where Buddha
went.
Or sorry,
where he's at. Gosh, I have
no idea. Yeah. When he left Earth, he went to Tushita. Before he came to Earth.
Wonder.
I thought they considered the Earth is pure realm as well, or something. Isn't the Earth is Chakmunibuddhi's pure realm?
Yeah, I'll just go around.
Can we hear this? Have you finished?
Yeah.
Or do we have to meditate now?
Let's just do Gewan. Do you know Gewan?
No, is it in our...
Didn't bring that.
I think it is. We're going to do a dedication. Yeah, it's in your prayer book. We're just going to do a dedication. It's really good.
We're going to do a dedication, and it's very, like, tremendous karma to be studying such holy things. And then you should send it out to people who I think aren't fortunate enough to, like, have Dharma in their lives and who aren't fortunate enough to see that there's a way to not suffer anymore, you know, and maybe hope that their suffering will end really soon.
Yeah.